Thursday, September 19th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. A Twitter user named Amuse posted a video from March of 2024 of a Springfield, Ohio City Council meeting. This user has 400,000 followers, describes what he does as conservative headlines with a dash of satire and AI. But this video did not seem altered. In it, a man, a citizen wearing a flannel shirt, spoke to the council.
And one of the things that I heard that bothered me very much, I've actually had quite a few people contact me here lately, is some pretty horrid things occurring to domesticated animals in the neighborhood.
The video was retweeted by Elon Musk, and it was picked up by another Twitter user named Dustin Grage. Grage is a Minnesota political consultant. Grage gained a bit of notoriety this election season by attempting to start a rumor or to levy another pet-related charge that Tim Walz had swapped out dogs named Scout. There's a new Scout. Where's the old Scout? It was just Tim Walz posing with someone else's dog. In this video, Grage wrote, quote, "Now we have the Springfield city manager acknowledging on video that they've heard of complaints of domestic animals being eaten back in March. But that man speaking wasn't the city manager, Brian Heck. I posted a picture of Heck beneath a video of the guy to point this out. I researched the overall council meeting. I found it. I found that the citizen's name is Mark Sanders. But when I posted a picture of Heck and said, that guy's not Heck, Grage answered and corrected me. And he said, no, he meant that Heck was the next voice in the video, which I'm going to play you in a second. Heck was sitting alongside or with the city council. And here's what city manager Heck says after citizen Mark Sanders mentioned him.
Shake your head, Brian.
No. I asked me if there was proof. There
okay.
No,
just don't have proof
if,
of it.
I have the same thing.
People that have confided in me have asked me for anonymity. I can't give their names up.
So that was Heck talking. Is there proof? Heck asked. Can't offer any names, says Sanders. Then the mayor of Springfield, Rob Rue, chimes in. That's the last 4 seconds of the video posted by Elon Musk and Grage.
I mean, we haven't seen the proof that you're talking about. And I've heard about it too.
Yeah.
So after I posted my comment on Grage's video, which did not seem to show at all what Grage said it showed, the city manager acknowledging that there were pets who were abducted, Grage wrote on Twitter, quote, "Brian Heck is the city manager," which he goes on to state, "I've heard about it too. Sorry, that was hard for you." That last part, that little snideness, that was at me. And not as hard as syntax seems to be for Grage. But also, and most importantly, Grage is wrong. He's just wrong. At the risk of a dumb Twitter feud, I wrote, "Nope, you got that wrong. Heck asks for proof," parentheses, there is none. The last part was Mayor Rue, who said he's heard rumors. Let me ask you, if you're wrong about that, which you were, or were misled into thinking it was Heck saying he's heard of pet eating, might you be wrong about the whole thing? And to credit Grage, he writes back, "Well, I take your remark and I apologize." No, he didn't write that back. He went silent. I nudged him once more, not in a confrontational way, I don't think. "I not have cared. I am not a one-man truth squad." But Grage is a political operative. He is routinely identified in media reports opining about Republican Minnesota politics. He self-identifies as a columnist for Town Hall. He links to his site where you could hire him to run your political or non-political campaigns. The site contains syntax just as sterling as some of his tweets. It's interesting to me to see someone caught, blatantly caught in a deception. Okay, maybe it was an honest mistake. And just to see what they do. In this case, the answer is nothing. And why? Well, nothing's the obvious play if what you want to do is spread rumors of pet eating in Springfield and the media covering it up. By that, I mean, Grage's tweet has been viewed 3.7 million times. My correction, a little less than 3,000. On the show today, I shall bring you a full interview, a full show interview with an actual elected official by name, correctly named. His name is Wes Moore. He's the governor of Maryland. Now, I have to tell you, we had 15 minutes with the governor. I pushed it to 20, so I had to make a choice. And I did not, in this interview, ask him about a recently reported incident in which he wrongly accepted the designation of Bronze Star recipient in interviews and once, according to New York Times, in a claim on an application to be a White House fellow. Moore has answered for this. You could look that up. You could find his answer. I just knew that my questioning about it would have contained the question, an attempt to head off what I knew to be his answer. He would have brushed that aside. He would have insisted, and maybe this is his right, to give a full explanation of what happened. Then I would feel compelled to ask a pertinent follow-up, and then he'd inevitably want to engage on that point. Anyway, I was foreseeing this would take up a quarter of my time, so I could have just turned down the interview. I did that, actually, once, and an upcoming guest was pitched to me, and I knew I'd have to spend so much time talking about a controversy in his life that I just turned down the interview. I think that's legitimate enough. In this interview, I just didn't want to spend all my time doing this back and forth and not getting to the issues I wanted to get to. I wanted to get to twice as many issues as I could. Anyway, this opens me up to criticism, maybe, for going soft or not pursuing a relevant issue. But I felt all I could do was make the choice that I made and explain it to you. If I had to do it again, I'd make the same choice. But if you want to tell me why that was wrong, my email box is always open at thegist@mikepesca.com. And oh, by the way, speaking of politics and Mike and looking at me as I talk, we have an interview up with Bradley Tusk. We taped a video of it. We're going to be doing more of it. This was at Bradley's bookstore. It doesn't seem like a bookstore. It seems like a podcast studio because it's a podcast studio and a bookstore. Anyway, go to youtube.com/PescaGist to check it out. Or just look in our show notes. You can watch that. See me. I'm bald. And here now, Governor Wesley Moore. Governor Wes Moore is the governor of the state of Maryland. He's an incredibly popular governor. Now, Maryland's a Democratic state, but he enjoys 64% approval rating against only 25% of Marylanders who don't. Almost universal approval in the Maryland black community. 51% of white Marylanders like the governor, and I think I know why. There's an old phrase, and he probably knows this from his days playing sports. They don't care about how much you know until they know about how much you care. And I've been watching the career of the governor. He goes around to rural areas. He goes to Republicans. He goes to white people, black people, Hispanic people. And he communicates to them that I'm listening and I'm here for you. He's here for us now. Welcome to The Gist.
Oh, it's great to be on with you. This is great. This is great.
So how are you going to spend down that approval? Because you can't just be happy to be at 65% and say, I'm not going to risk it. What initiatives are you going to initiate in order to maybe risk it a little?
Well, you know, I think part of the reason that that people like what we're doing and we seem to be popular in the state is because we've managed to get some really big things done. We just managed to get them done together. And I think when you're looking at the kind of numbers that we have, it's not just because you're popular amongst Democrats, is that we're popular amongst independents and even a good chunk of Republicans. And I think, you know, you look at some of the things we've gotten done already, where Maryland is now the first state in the country that has a service year option for all of our high school graduates, that Maryland now is the first state in the country that has a pathway for free dental care and health care for members of our National Guard, that Maryland now has taken a full frontal assault on the issue of child poverty, being the first state in the country that now has a place-based strategy when it comes to the issue of child poverty, that we've now had a pardon of 175,000 cannabis convictions, the largest mass pardon in the history of the United States. But we've gotten done by actually working together on these issues. And so, you know, we know that we're going to create pathways for work, wages, and wealth for all Marylanders. We know we are going to end this issue of child poverty that the people of our state, that too many children of our state continue to deal with. But we know we're going to do it in a way that's going to create real measurements and real pathways of bringing everybody on board. And I think that's what's making people excited right now.
I did want to ask you about child poverty. I read about it in your state of the state, and I know it was a big initiative. Under President Biden's plan, child poverty was cut in half, but then the funding for that evaporated. My question is the way to end child poverty, this might seem naive, is to give more money to alleviate child poverty? Is there a sustainable way where people won't be in a position, poor people or poor children, won't be in a position to be poor to begin with?
There's a multitude of ways to address them. And it was frustrating because the child tax credit is one of the most effective ways to being able to address the issue of child poverty. President Biden did a huge deal by introducing the child tax credit on the federal level, but unfortunately Congress then let it lapse. But when you're looking at even the proposals that we've now seen from Vice President Harris, that she would do as if she becomes the president of the United States, talking about a $6,000 child tax credit would be a massive blow to child poverty inside of our state. And it's something that, you know, the reason that I am so supportive of her, the reason that I'm deeply excited about what a Harris administration could actually bring on board, is when you're able to do all the things that we know are going to be necessary and required, which is getting more parents, more people employed. You know, part of the focus we've had in Maryland was to invest in trade programs and apprenticeship programs, and saying that just because you don't have a four-year college degree does not mean that you should not have pathways to economic success. And when I was inaugurated, Maryland was 43rd in the country in unemployment. Now we're going on 12 straight months of amongst the lowest unemployment rates in the entire country. The unemployment rate in the state of Maryland right now is 2.8%. So you've got to get parents and guardians employed. You need to make sure they're getting paid fair wages for their work, because if you get paid fair wages for your work, the core beneficiary is going to be your children and the people who are living in your home. And then the third thing is you need to create pathways to long-term wealth. And that means housing. That means supporting entrepreneurship. If you can do those things and also couple them with things like the child tax credit, couple them things like expungement policies, then you are going to be able to really be on a path to end child poverty. And that's why I think that, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris is frankly the only one running for president with a real plan to be able to address that.
Let's talk about housing. How much of the problem with affordable housing, and this just isn't among lower income people, the middle class is finding housing extremely unaffordable and up the economic ladder. How much of that blame is because of government policies? Why doesn't housing act like every other good where the market meets demand because people are incentivized to supply housing for people who can buy it and then everyone makes a profit? Why doesn't that work with housing?
Amen. Government has been one of the biggest problems when it comes to housing policies. And I think that, you know, one thing that we saw, we this year, Maryland, we passed the most comprehensive and frankly, the largest housing package in the history of the state of Maryland. And a lot of people, to your point, Mike, they're like, don't touch housing. Housing is complicated. Housing is not politically popular. But here's what I knew, that over 30% of young Marylanders were considering leaving the state for one reason, housing costs. They could not find places to stay. And so we had to be able to do a better job of doing things like incentivizing creation of more housing. We had to do a better job of actually incentivizing development. We had to do a better job of transit-oriented development, a better job of density bonuses, a better job of making sure that you don't have so much regulatory red tape, and where you have locals who and local land commissioners who had more power than the governor about where things could go and where things could be situated. And we just have I have a core philosophy that I agree that you should not build everywhere. I understand that. But in the places that you can build, you should build. And you need to create more inventory for people to be able to have a chance to be owners and have a chance to have a stable place to be able to live with their family and focus on affordable housing. And so, you know, Maryland took a huge step forward in this past year of making that happen. But a lot of it, to your point, it had to be government needed to stop getting in the way, and government needed to actually incentivize tools to create better pathways for people within our states.
If we're being honest, isn't this more of a problem that was created by Democratic governments, cities like San Francisco and New York, with a tremendous amount of regulation? There are other things going on, extremely hard to build. We have a city like Houston without those dynamics. The word that used to be ascribed to it was sprawl. I hear sprawl being talked about less, and I hear YIMBYism being talked about more. So I don't mind. I know you have a degree in finance or a background in finance as well as the military. But just to be honest, would you say that some Democratic policies have been the cause for much of the problem in the past in this area?
Oh, yeah. I don't think you can blame a political party, but also I don't think any political party has been absolved of this problem either. I think we have seen enough blame to go around for both leaders who were both Democrats and Republicans on this issue. And the problem is that the people who have been the core losers in that have been the people. Because you get these political parties who are then going back and forth on this issue. And listen, you're right. I mean, I don't come from a political background. I don't come from a political family. The first office I ever ran for was governor. And I ran almost out of a sense of frustration. And then I ended up winning. So I was like, all right, well, now that we're in the seat, we're going to do things a little bit different here. And I know that part of the blame, yes, it does fall on people who were Democrats. It falls on people who were Republicans. And so the way we have to be able to approach this is to say from a state level, we have to have a greater level of involvement in what happens in local jurisdictions. For local jurisdictions, you have to have a better partner within your state and your federal partners who are going to increase access to capital, who are going to support first-time home buyers, who are going to incentivize renters to become owners. But you had to create a better way for people to have a sense of ownership and a sense of and a real tangible sense of connection to the neighborhoods they're living in.
I have never heard you say anything about striking down the Second Amendment, and I know you're familiar with guns, but of course you're also familiar with the fact that the city of Baltimore is one of the most crime-besotted cities. Although this year, thus far, I was just looking at the newspapers in Baltimore, 135 homicide victims compared to all of last year, 334 and 330. Five in 2020. So this means that it does seem like murder is down tremendously and 40%. But the question is, and we should also stipulate that, should these trends continue, Baltimore will have a homicide rate of about 30 per 100,000 versus 6 in New York. As tremendous a gain as that is, what has Baltimore done differently this year to make those numbers fall? Can you keep doing it?
Yeah, I mean, and I love this, Mike, because, you know, when I first came on board as governor, we had seen how Baltimore had 300 plus homicides for 8 straight years. Literally for the entire duration of my predecessor's time as governor, Baltimore was killing fields. And I came in and I said, I refuse to be a governor who is just going to attend funerals and give thoughts and prayers without doing a single thing to be able to address this issue. And so when we came on board, I said, we're going to take an all of the above approach. We're going to make record investments in law enforcement and actually local law enforcement and making sure we're getting more boots on ground. We're going to make record investments in technology and predictive analytics and showing that you can actually close cases when these things happen. That we're going to invest in not just our state's attorneys, but also Maryland's now in the only states that actually takes balance sheet to invest in the U.S. attorney, because we've moved a lot of these cases when it comes to guns and gun trafficking and violence. You move them into federal cases because those sentences are longer. And we've also made investments in violence reduction platforms and in community groups. And the results, to your point, have been staggering, where in our first 19 months, we've now seen not only has Baltimore had amongst the most precipitous drops of homicides of anywhere in America, and the state of Maryland has had some of the fastest drops of anywhere in the state in this country. But also, the last time the homicide rate was this low in Baltimore at this time of the year, I wasn't born yet. That's the kind of drops that we've seen. And so I'm proud of the work that we've been able to do together. I'm proud of the fact that we've been able to really take this all of the above approach and work with local jurisdictions and our federal partners to be able to reduce gun violence, reduce violent crime, reduce the homicide rate, and make our community safer. We still have more work to do, but the answer of, you know, can we keep this going? My answer is absolutely, and I'm committed to it.
Is it important to take the all of the above approach just because, hey, with a horrible problem, let's throw solutions at the wall? Or is it more the case that there are certain interventions that you could probably prove work much better than others? I read a lot of criminology. More police does correlate to lower crime, costs literal and figuratively notwithstanding. That is true. Violence interrupters, for instance, which are some programs you've used, less effective. But when you go to the community, you can sell them on, yes, we are putting more police in the street, but we also have this raft, these other programs. So we're not giving up on anything. So that's my question. Is it more of a communication technique to have the all of the above approach than anything else?
Well, you know, I think what it is, and I think what people have seen from us here in Maryland, is, you know, I say as a leader, I am data driven and heart led, where I wear my heart on my sleeve and I acknowledge that, but I don't move without data. If you ever want to get me to move on anything, you must show me data that it actually works. In fact, the organization that I ran before I ran for governor was one of the largest poverty fighting organizations in this country. But it was also an organization that prided itself on data driven decisions. And we could give you the societal ROI on every single dollar that we invested. We take the same approach in the state of Maryland. And so the reason, to your point, that we invested more in local law enforcement wasn't because it sounded good or because of a political ideology. It's because the data continue to show that if you have jurisdictions where you have massive, massive vacancies when it comes to local law enforcement, then you are going to have a problem being able to actually not just counter crime, but close cases. The reason that we said we're going to invest in technology and predictive analytics was because the data showed that there were certain technologies that were very useful when it came to making sure that people were captured. And if a person knew that I was going to be involved in a violent crime, if I was going to be involved in drug trafficking, and I knew that my face was going to be on camera, if I knew that within 24 hours I would be captured, people thought about that when it came to how they were thinking about living their lives. And so the reason that I think these things have worked and the reason we've invested in them is because these are data driven decisions, which I think really has to be the way you frame out everything that you do when it comes to governance.
Yep. When it comes to crime reduction, swift, certain, and fair
is
what the experts say has to happen. They also predict once you start closing more cases, which is to say solving cases and pairing a murderer with a murder, there's supposed to be a flywheel effect that you'll get more credibility, that more people will come to the cops. Are you seeing that? Will you at least commit to researching that? Because it seems like Baltimore is doing a natural experiment here.
We are. And in fact, we already have. In fact, in our last legislative session, I've introduced 26 pieces of legislation. We've gone 26 for 26. And by the way, we've gone 26 for 26 bipartisan with both Democrat and Republican support on every bill we've introduced. One of the bills we introduced was something called the Victims Compensation Act. What the Victims Compensation Act basically says is that if a person is a victim of crime, the best person to actually help to solve that case is the victim. But the problem is, in many cases, they don't cooperate. Mm-hmm. They're scared to. They don't feel like they're going to be protected. They don't feel like it's going to help to bring closure to the case. And so by being able to better support victims of crimes, you actually do a better job of helping to close cases. When you close cases, people know that they're not going to get away with crime. And so you're absolutely right. This becomes a cycle that as this continues to come out and people understand that we're not playing, that the behavior begins to change. It's part of the reason that we've been able to work with our U.S. attorney and turn more of these cases into federal cases. Because if you get a federal, you get 15 years or 20 years on federal, you're doing 15 or 20 years. You're not doing 5 on good behavior. And you know who we've noticed who pays attention to that? The people who are committing these kinds of crimes. And yeah. So you're right. There is almost this idea that winners win. There's also this idea of if you can get the trend lines moving in the right direction, it's actually going to influence behavior, which will further increase the chances of these trend lines continuing.
And back in a minute, we will talk more with Governor Moore about his thesis, which was about international terrorism. We're back again with the governor of Maryland, Wes Moore. Now, I know I haven't been able to read it. I haven't got my hands on it. You wrote The Rise and Ramifications of Radical Islam in the Western Hemisphere as your thesis when you were a Rhodes Scholar at Johns Hopkins. Is that right?
That when I was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. So, yes.
At Oxford. That's where the Rhodes Scholar is.
That's right.
So did you find, and I want to bring it up to relevancies in the modern times, but did you find there is one school of thought that says when people are in such deprived circumstances, they are going to become radical? And there's another school of thought that says, actually, it's not the absolute standards, it's the dashed hopes, it's the gap between expectations and reality. What did you find?
It's a great question. And I think we found the answer is it's both. That the realities of people were living in, was that driving them to, in many cases, radicalized ideologies? Yes. It was also the situation that radicalized ideologies were also then justified by the situations that people were existing in. You know, I remember when I was, I led soldiers in combat in Afghanistan. I was with the 82nd Airborne Division. And so we led paratroopers as something part of called Task Force Devil in some one of the earlier days of the Afghan campaign. And I remember I was talking with a senior NCO and he said something I thought was really interesting. He said, who's the most dangerous person out here for us? Mm-hmm. Is it the ideologue? Is it the this? Is it that? And he said, the most dangerous person out here for us is the person who hasn't worked in 18 months because they will do anything for a paycheck. You know, even if it means sitting on the top of a mountain with a cell phone, and when they see an American convoy go by, push send on the cell phone, knowing that you're about to set off a daisy chain for an IED. And so I think the battle that we have when it comes to this idea of radical ideologies is there are multiple ways of getting into the radicalized ideology. Part of it is ideological, right? But part of it is a situational. And I think that, you know, the challenge is that we are seeing people who are entering into this idea through multiple different means, which is both getting them there and keeping them there.
So I wanted to use that and ask you about the situation in Israel. I would imagine you have some insights that not many governors have. Probably it's not the case that State Department's calling the governor of Maryland to figure out some things. But from what you know, there is a school of thought that says, and you ran the counterinsurgency manual, that it is impossible to placate or put down a homegrown insurgency through violence. On the other hand, Al-Qaeda has been defeated. The Taliban, well, they essentially won, or, you know, the United States left. What do you think is possible with how much Israel can do to functionally degrade Hamas, maybe to the point where they will say, we've done all we can do and accept a ceasefire?
Yeah, you know, and I think part of the challenge is, and you know, you brought it up, Mike, where I actually did my work on the rise and ramifications of radical Islamism in the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, I studied groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda. And so I've studied them for a long time. The thing that I know is the when you look at not just the origins of Hamas, but also the actions of Hamas, they're not fair nor honest brokers inside this war. They're not fair or honest brokers inside this battle. And the goals of Hamas are not conducive to an idea of a long-term stable state or a two-state solution, nor a place where Palestinians and Israelis can live peacefully and coexist side by side with self-determination as the goal. And so this becomes the fundamental challenge that we have with a lot of these situations, where in order to get to a conclusion point, you need to have partners and leaders who have the same intentions and have the same goals. Where, you know, I think, you know, the idea of a peaceful two-state solution, that is the answer. We also need to have partners who can help us to get there and who believe that that is the correct answer. And so it's heartbreaking, to say the least, to know that we have this situation where we still have hostages who have not come home to their families, and hostages who we've lost in this process. It's heartbreaking to know that the pain that's happened on the, you know, for so many innocent Palestinians inside this war. This atrocity and this pain that we've seen, it's heartbreaking. But we need to make sure that you have partners who actually believe in the humanity and believe in the peaceful existence in order for us to be able to get there. And that, I think, is the fundamental challenge that we still wrestle with in this moment.
Should you ever be in a position to have some say over what U.S. currency is minted, okay? Like if, I don't know, who knows, maybe in a few years, would you seriously consider or even commit to eliminating the wasteful minting of pennies?
Oh my gosh. I had not thought about that.
No one does. I asked Pete Buttigieg this. He punted. You could be on the record as saying, yeah, I'll be the penny guy.
I'll be the person who eliminates pennies from the person who makes pennies worth something because they won't be worth anything.
But I don't know if you read that big piece by Katie Weaver in the New York Times. We waste so much money on minting pennies. They cost much more than a penny to mint. Why?
Honestly, it's a fair point. It's a very good point. I think there's a whole lot of things that we actually waste money on that I think we need to take seriously and move on. But I had not done enough thinking on the elimination of the penny. But it's an interesting idea, actually. I need to dig in. I need to call up Pete. I need to call up Pete and ask him.
Wesley Moore is the 63rd governor of Maryland. Thank you so much.
This is my pleasure, man. Great to talk to you.
And that's it for today's show. Also, if you like yesterday's show, wherein I talked to Bradley Tusk, I did that at his bookstore, PNT Knitwear. We made a video of it. Go to the Gist's video page. It's on a service called YouTube. And the place where it specifically resides is at PescaGist. That is youtube.com/@PescaGist. How about we just put a link to it right here in the show notes? And let me also tell you that Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Leo Baum bounds it up as our intern here at The Gist. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/The Gist. Oomperu, jeeperu, duperu, as they say, sometimes more smoothly than that. Thanks for listening.